Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is August 22nd, 2002. Today's session is Mountain Stories, Patagonia and Other Stories, presented by Jonathan Ferrix. The number is FRJ 2002-10. Let's listen in.
Tell a couple short stories. Show some pictures from Patagonia, where there are two of the most incredible mountains in the world that I had the privilege to walk around one time because I was down nearby for a meeting at the Argentine Air Force. Can fly you anywhere for about $50 on their transport plane. So some slides of Patagonia and a couple stories. And then, do you all want to tell some stories of your own? We could start with that.
No.
We know our stories.
Okay. The other option is to finish off the canyon. I have a whole bunch of slides that I didn't show last night. I could flip through them in probably 10 minutes without talking too much if I put a clamp on my mouth. And then I wanted to spend a little bit of time, if we have it, just to point out a couple things from this book. I asked the bookstore to carry a commercial book, and John Krakauer probably doesn't need any more money from this book. It was a bestseller for a long time. But it's really an excellent story. How many people have read it? Yeah, Into Thin Air.
He also
prefaces to each chapter, which are the most amazing collection of little tiny snippets, like almost devotionals around why do people climb mountains.
He has another book out. It's 10 climbs that he's made or other people have made that I gave to a friend of mine that's a mountain climber.
Really?
Yeah, it's a short, there are all the articles he's written from different magazines, and he pulled them together and then wrote one more for that book.
Yeah.
But it, from Delali to the icicles to K2 to Iger.
So what should we do?
Quick slides.
Okay.
Do the slides.
Some more slides?
Yeah. Andy's, your story is Patagonia.
Don't let the people with the big voices dominate. Well, since we got the slides going, how about if we do some Andes in Patagonia? It's all South America. And
while you get set up, I would like to tell just a little bitty story.
Please.
In 1959, that's a while back. Another young friend and I, we decided to see the Cascades, so we drove up from Marble Mount, and some of you have probably been up Cascade Pass, and that place has the, shall we say, latrine with the most beautiful view.
Donnie Pass?
Story, no. Cascade Pass. End of story,
right? We can have a beautiful latrine view stories.
Oh yeah. There's one up a Knife Lake, Bonnie Waters Wilderness, on one of the islands out there. It's this little crag out in the middle of this beautiful lake, and on top of the crag, I don't know why, but that's where the Forest Service has plopped their box.
Right.
I suppose it was the only place in the whole island that was the appropriate distance away from shore.
Okay.
But you go up there and sit, and you look down, probably more looks like a beer commercial as far as you can see. It's just tremendous.
Okay, so we got Cloudy Pass and Knife Lake. Any others?
There's up in the canyon, you walk to the mountain called Castle Mountain. Is a latrine you can only climb up to a class like 5.9. And it sits on this ridge, and it's outlooking across to like Lake Louise, Moraine Lake, that area over there. So you're up on the side of this cliff. You just look at this amazing view. I've never been up there, I just saw pictures.
My question would be, after you've climbed to 5.9, would you have anything to offer?
That's not the point, it's just kind of cool.
I think they do these on purpose on those nice high points.
I hope so.
Even Lena Lake, which is not that far up in the staircase, up in the Olympic Peninsula, has the most beautiful. You want to sit there forever, you know, because the view is so nice.
Well,
yeah.
Now there's a book
that's
why
they call
for
it
anybody.
A throne.
A book in waiting for anybody who has a desire.
Finally.
Latrines of the View.
Boxes with a view. Well, you still been boxes.
What you started.
Okay, these are the little kids going down to...
Turn off the lights?
Yeah.
I'll get them.
Going down to Flint from this little village. And the teacher here was so good with them. And to be a teacher in one of these remote villages after you've been through teacher's college, you know, it's really a sacrifice for most people from the way we think about our jobs and our fulfillment. There's the class. She had them all write me a thank you card because I suggested we go swimming. We had come through this stretch the night before at 9:30 after 15 hours of hiking, and I was really beat. And I was carrying too much weight, and it was just bad. We've been up and down many, many things. And I said, I'm going to count steps on this last pitch because I didn't know how high the village was going to be. And I said, I bet it's 1,000 steps. Got to 1,000, we weren't there. Got to 2,000, we weren't there. Got to 3,000, we weren't there. We got there 3,200 steps. So the next morning, when I said we go swimming, they scampered down the same thing. They thought nothing of it. That was the view on the way home, one of the views on the way home.
Lonnie says she took all the children pictures, is that true?
I'm sorry, it's not true.
Okay.
She wasn't with me at this point. These are geraniums at about 13,000 feet.
Wild ones, I assume.
Well, it was near a village. You see this all the time. Mostly women, and also men, coming back with all kinds of foliage. Sometimes so much you can't see them. And they're out getting stuff for their cows or sheep or goats that are in their courtyards. And so coming home one night, we saw a cow with two little baby calves that born that day. And Lonnie gave her first hug to a calf. And then we saw brand new baby goat, two-day-old baby goat. That's our town again. See the snow on the mountains?
What are they growing in their fields?
Those crops I talked about, kiwicha, kaniwa, quinoa, three grains that you don't have here that are wonderful, corn, different kinds of corn. Beans, vegetables.
Potatoes.
Oh, that's where they come from.
Yeah. Are there any haciendas in that area, or are they all small farmers?
Mostly small, but one guy had 30 topos, which is about 60 acres, which made him a pretty big guy. I think that's right.
What you're saying is the quinoa, we call quinoa, and it's available here?
No.
Our food co-op
has it. Yeah, quinoa is available here, right? Mm-hmm. Kiwicha is called amaranth, I think.
Okay, amaranth's available too.
Is it? Mm-hmm. I like sorghum. It's a relative of sorghum.
Yeah.
It's really good for you. See the Spanish style on balconies and things? This is the town that I said was sort of racist. I feel like you're in, you know, the place they filmed.
Which Cassidy and Sundance
Which kid? Cassidy and Sundance
Looks just like it.
There's the head of Aedes. She's about 4'8" in the middle. And she's talking to two people that she knows. Well, we waited for a... You go around in little tiny minibuses that we counted 28 people in one time. They're just the size of regular minivans. But we counted 28 people in one. And Lonnie found one with 6 people on the roof. Now we went up to a very high place where they've done almost the most work on their planning schedule. And you really feel like, wow, why do people live here? Because it's so barren and it's so cold and so high. It's called Puica. It's looking down on it. And you see the mixture of houses in use and then houses that have just been left. The roof has fallen in and they haven't replaced them.
Okay.
They used to have grass roofs which would burn and decay. Now they have copper, these are corrugated iron. Look at all the terraces on the other side. If you didn't terrace, you couldn't live here because there's almost no flat soil.
What happened to the former population, you know, when somebody abandoned houses?
Yeah, a lot are in town. Peru is hugely urbanized. A third of the country lives in Lima. 8 million out of 26 million live in Lima.
How do they get the corrugated stuff up there?
This has a road.
It has roads,
okay. But other places they carry it on donkeys.
Okay.
Above that town, about an hour's walk on a spur at even higher altitude, is this ruin. And it's from the Wari people who were probably, it's probably from 700 AD. And when you look at it closely, look at that door. The only mortar is mud. And it's 1,300 years old, and it's been through an enormous number of earthquakes and all of that weather, and it's still there. And you felt like they were building better back then than they are now because the society was more intact. That's my cheap, simple explanation.
Do they have glass in their windows?
No, not back then. Now they do. Just a view again of the ruins with the hills. You know, we're losing the top of the picture. Would you mind just pushing the projector back about a half inch and it'll get off of the...
What's the elevation?
No, the lip that it's on, it's the machine itself. Just push it back. There.
What's the elevation of that ruin?
That ruin is 3,800 meters, so it's 14,000 feet.
Oh boy.
It's amazing to think it's flat at the top.
Yeah, that, you know, it does drop away, but it picks on up. On the way back down, you meet another little herd of llamas.
And alpacas.
And then there was a meeting that day, which is why we were there, of the local women's association. And so you have a whole bunch of moms and a whole bunch of babies, and the babies don't need childcare. They just come to the meeting. So this little guy came in this, which is like a backpack cradle that his mom came in with. And they had their own little meeting on the floor while the grown-ups were talking upstairs. It was all about getting better chickens going, how to do it, how to do composting, how to do some better varieties of seeds, and what some of the issues were in each of their communities vis-a-vis that long-term plan. There's the woman with the cradle backpack. See?
Excuse me, I haven't been to some of your others. What was your role in all of this? What were you working with? Youth in the World?
Yeah, I was here on sabbatical to try to live in a project area for a long enough time that I could kind of. It's like a little bit of the idea of that book, Black Like Me.
Yeah.
But I would have had to cut off, you know, my legs below the knee to blend in with the people.
Yeah.
And dye my hair and become a lot faster hiking because they were able to go up and down those mountains like goats. But still, and talk better Spanish.
I imagine their blood picture was a very different than yours too.
Their blood what?
Their
red blood cells?
Red blood cells, yeah.
You would like to have their red blood cells.
They would be loaded.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You could go to Heart Lake in, 40 minutes.
40 minutes.
What's life expectancy?
For all of Peru, it's not too bad. I think it's 67. But there's high infant mortality still.
Yeah.
And protein deficiency for kids. And that ecotourism that I talked about, one proposal we're making is that maybe the tourists could, if you charge them for anything, you could say, your money's going to be used to give protein to our kids. Something real simple that outsiders could get a handle on and understand that this is a problem and I can do something about it by the way I choose to spend my money. It's a long way off. I mean, tourism could get totally taken over by, Walt Disney could come in and take over this place. Another shelf village. And we're on our way now to a lake. There are lakes also to visit and to encourage people to see. But before we got there, we stopped and asked if a couple of the village men could come with us, and we'd hire them as guides. And the kids of one of the guides were skinning cooies.
Guinea pigs.
Which are guinea pigs.
No one believes it. They eat guinea pigs.
Yeah, so they had killed them. They were boiling the skin, just like how you pluck a chicken.
Put them in the hot water.
How's your breakfast doing?
Does that allow the skin to come loose free or the fur to come off?
The fur.
Like a pig.
Yeah.
So they don't use the fur.
I have.
It does not taste like chicken.
Oh, it
tastes like chicken.
It's more
like goat.
Okay. Well, let's hear it for goats.
Pork. No, it's stringy. And
some pictures of food. Soup is the food. Yes. You get soup for breakfast, soup for lunch, soup for supper. And it's made of the stuff that they're growing with. This case, I think there's potatoes, these spring onions, and pieces of locally matured cheese that everybody makes in their households.
And it tastes a little more like dust.
And then one of many kinds of potatoes, in this case boiled, with pieces of that cheese. And that actually made a great, great lunch.
Hey, how was your stomach gastrointestinal life?
You know, I followed, again, people are so scared of that, but you know, I didn't eat anything raw that I hadn't peeled myself. And I didn't drink the water without the iodine pills, or unless it had been boiled. And I think I had, you know, two small episodes of XYZ, but nothing chronic, nothing. So it's real possible to
do. Is the cheese made from goat milk?
I think it's cows.
Cow's milk.
Yeah. It didn't taste like goat. Avocados, beautiful avocados on the left. And then this is toasted corn. Fantastic. And then cheese. Now here's the woman whose kids were skinning the guinea pigs. And she was an amazing woman. You just hope that her skills and talents are able to be shared with her neighbors and make a difference in her village. And with Aedes' help, it's possible they are. That is happening. She and a neighbor had stuck two sticks in the ground, and they were weaving this right there on that loom.
Oh,
instant loom. And the little girl was helping. And here's the yarn. Some of it natural from alpaca, some of it purchased. You can see the color difference. Mm-hmm.
Now, are they selling some of the goods that they weave now?
Yeah, but there's not too many people to buy them. And how do you get them out over that road? So a lot of things are going against them. That's why they're organizing to try to do just a QE check for the time being.
Just to basically be able to market things.
Something, yeah. They're trying. I have in my bag, I have a lettuce cream jar. Did you know you can make a nice hand cream from lettuce? Well, they're doing it there. They've got a process to process lettuce with the simple distill. And they're making cream out of local herbs. But again, who's going to buy it and how are they going to ship it and all that stuff? But they're trying. As we climbed higher, you get this incredible, I don't know what it is. Is it a moss? Is it a lichen? It's about the size of a huge cabbage. And it grows in groups, and you can actually burn it. The only thing up there to burn. But it's been protected now because too many people were burning it.
Could you point out what you're talking about there?
This green stuff is like a huge living thing at 16,000 feet. That is like the last living thing you see when you get up on the Altiplano on this area.
Is that what they use for fuel?
Up high when you're camping. And
now, what do these people use for fuel if it's against
eucalyptus.
The
law?
Eucalyptus?
Yeah.
And that grows up there too?
No, but down where they live. They don't live like
that. Oh, okay.
This is too high to live. Well, that's not true. A few families do, but in this case, that's what we're living at. We were on our way to see a lake, one of the tourist attractions, to check out, you know, is it going to work as groups come through. and we took horses the last bit. And that was our last view before we spent the night in what was promised to be a cave. But our guides never, the first cave came too fast and they didn't want to stop. The second cave had snow in it, and there wasn't a third cave. So we pulled up next to a rock and slept in the lee of the rock. And there's the rock, and there's our horses. And we put up, we had a tent, the four of us who were not from the valley, and then the two local men were starting to, I was wondering how they were going to sleep, because there wasn't room in the tent, and they showed no interest in using our tent. They took their horse blankets off, put them down on a piece of plastic, and then took all of their blankets and put them all on top of each other, and trotted underneath with two other men who showed up off the Altiplano, one of them wearing sandals, and 2 feet of snow. And two donkeys, each donkey carrying two sheep in their penny, in their side baskets. They had rescued from the snow up in the Altiplano. So again, the toughness is incredible. Here's how they were sleeping, and he put a couple sheep on both ends. You know the song Three Dog Night?
Yeah.
Well, this is a two sheep night. And they were up most of the night, it sounded to me, talking and laughing and having a great time and sleeping head to toe, so that there as much of each other was touching to keep warm, all under one blanket, but about three blankets thick. And it was probably 10 degrees that night. Next morning we headed out for the lake, and the snow just got deeper and deeper. Now you see the Altiplano, that's how it looks around there. This is 4,800 meters.
What's the city up there that you were mentioning?
Arequipa?
No, the big city.
Arequipa is the biggest city.
Arequipa?
Yeah. But it's down a bit. It's down off the Altiplano. It's at a nice altitude. This guy was he's a budding tourist guide, student at an institute in Arequipa. And he got a burro, a mule, so it's half horse, half donkey. And is this the one? No, he does have a halter, but no bit. No bit. Mine didn't have a bit either. But one of them just had a rope around the side, so he's trying to steer his mule with just a rope around one side. And at one point he fell off. The mule caught up with us without the rider. Here's the lake. And it was sort of an anticlimax because of the snow and the ice. But amazing to find. There's about four lakes on the various sides of the canyon. Little tiny piece of another kind of scenery there, the religious festivals that are a big deal in each village. This is the festival of the Virgin of Rosario, I think. Every time that Mary has had an apparition, you know, that is held on to for decades and centuries, and so this is the Virgin of the Rosario, and I'm not sure about the apparition behind it. But the church was full, and they had a procession around through the streets of these two Mary figures. I guess two Marys are better than one. And it became an occasion for quite a bit of drinking after this church service. And dancing. Has anybody been to Taiwan? Or parts of China, the ethnic groups in China?
Mm-hmm.
I swear this guy's costume. Do you want to see evidence for the land bridge to Asia? The way he danced, the kind of music they played with this old type of harp, it was like we were in Asia. And here you are in South America. And you know, I think, from this where the people originally came from, migrated from. Two donkeys that weren't able to take part in the celebration. Another village we were in, just all the kids get to go to what's called a garden, like kindergarten, preschool run by the state. And apparently it's very important for some because they're like here, some of the parents are working too hard. They're out in the field all day, the kids are by themselves. And so we were really impressed by some of the people we met at these gardens, these kindergartens, and how they took care of the kids.
These children don't look like they have protein deficiency.
Yeah, this village is lower down. I think the statistics still aren't that good. When you have clothes on, winter clothes on, it's pretty hard to see how good they really are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure some are fine, but I kept asking, and the statistics were always pretty serious.
It's usually the big belly that crush you over.
Yeah, that, you didn't see that. You didn't see that, but okay. But there's other forms of malnutrition. A communal work project where they're building a reservoir so their village can have more of water in the off months. And men and women were probably 250 of them were working together here. A little bit of a remembrance for those, what it would have taken to build those terraces and irrigate them. A 9-year-old goat herd all by herself on a mountainside. We come walking along and here she is, and she keeps her herd under her goat and sheep's under control. And just the competence of young people, because that's what you grow up and do. And I think it's worth noting, because boy, you don't feel like they have the same set of problems as young people that we do. There's a lot more responsibility, a lot more sense of how to behave, a lot more meaningful engagement, I think, in life. Maybe too much so, because she shouldn't be working, she should be in school, but this was after school.
Why this problem with the alcohol and drunkenness then?
You know, I asked about that a lot, and I really can't say, but one anthropologist I met who had just worked 2 years in northern Peru said that there is actually a physical, what's the word? Propensity to addiction in the indigenous peoples of the Americas.
Yeah. Like with the Indians, the American Indians.
Well, yeah, right. Hesitate to say it. Yeah, you hesitate to say it because it immediately almost is like saying they're less than we are.
No, not at all. It's a physical issue, but you wonder why.
Yeah, but it sure began to look like that once I heard that.
Well, you know, I worked in the field of addiction somewhere, and it has to do with how many generations you've been using alcohol.
Really?
Yeah, that you find more alcoholism among Scandinavians and Northern Europeans than you do in the
Italians.
Mediterranean area, because they've had alcohol many thousands of years longer.
Wow.
You mean the longer you've had it, the less likely for the addiction, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
The less likely for the biological predisposition.
Tuberculosis and measles and those types of diseases. Mm-hmm. You don't have an immunity for it.
So my German blood's pretty good for this?
Is that a dog or a goat?
They're all goats or sheep.
Okay.
Yeah. No. So that one in front of her is the dog.
Yeah.
She had one dog and herself and about 15 sheep and goats, and on this hillside, and then one of those irrigation ditches. Just another view. I mean, I couldn't stop taking pictures of what we were looking at. The sense of space makes you wonder: are all valleys this spectacular? Are they all this big?
And when you're there versus when you take a picture, the picture never looks as awesome as the beginning.
No, absolutely.
That's got to just be awesome.
Yeah.
But you notice how beautiful these pictures are. You cannot take a bad picture in Peru. The air is so clear.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't take a bad picture.
How far are you from the equator there?
The equator's up in Ecuador, so it's probably 1,000 miles away. Maybe not quite. We went up on the Altiplano to look for livestock that had suffered in that blizzard. Unseasonal blizzard. I think it actually made the news here in late June, early July. And we were too late really to find very much, but we stopped at this farm that we had connections to through the project, and they were busy skinning a sheep. And the things they grow and manage to live with at that altitude, this is way up there again, 15,000 feet, it's just stunning. And in the distance you see the point of that mountain I showed you earlier, Solimana. And then you go around Solimana and you see another mountain that's actually higher, 6,500 meters. Coropuna, that's it there. And the bus ride that I talked about yesterday spends about half of its time trying to get around that mountain. And it was a full moon and we watched that mountain from the bus window on the way out. We didn't get sick on the way out after living there for those 6 weeks. So it's spectacular to be amongst the snow in the middle of the night in this huge bus. And I don't know how they get the engine to run so well.
Would the snow melt during the day then?
No, not at that level. The flanks would, but that's permanent snow. We were on a 185cc Honda, two men, at 15,000 feet. So buy a Honda stock. For a little bike like that to take two, you know, we had 340 pounds of people on it. And it actually ran at that altitude. In the snow, I had to tell the pastor to get off so I could get through the snow. Just amazing. And we were being watched.
And listened to.
Okay, that's the end of the bruise. Have comments and stories while I switch.
Jonathan, is the train between Bolivia and Peru, the one that goes, you know, by Lake Titicaca, is that the highest train in the world?
Oh, it's gotta be. It's
1400 is almost as high as Mount Rainier, and there's no snow.
Yeah. No. They just deal with altitude that we can't even conceive of.
No.
And so does nature.
How's your lung power and heart adapt when you're living around, you know, 3,000 feet and all of a sudden you go up to
10 million?
Well, I really think it's just sort of a toss of a coin. Some people have no trouble for no apparent reason. Other people have a lot of trouble. Fit people have trouble. Unfit people don't have trouble. You can't predict what's going to happen. I know that to fly to like Puno or Lake Titicaca from Lima is to invite trouble because you're going instantly from 0 to 4,000 meters.
I took pills before I did that.
Yeah. And our guests, when I went there for work, our host offered us oxygen tank in our room, in our guest house room. They gave us an oxygen tank. He said, don't be shy, use this.
We also chewed the leaves.
Coca.
Mm-hmm.
Coca tea or chew coca leaves. The same stuff that you make cocaine from.
Leaves does not taste the same.
It's good for altitude. Yeah. But the trick is to do it gradually, no matter who you are. All right, this is going down on, in this case, a regular airline, and then getting on the Argentine Air Force plane to go to Patagonia after a meeting that I was at in southern Brazil. This is 10 years ago. And by the way, you know, if you looked at a couple of these sessions, they're very interesting places, and it probably looks like all I do is travel. I'm covering a span of 25 years in these slides. So I spend most of my time at a desk answering email.
Well, then I won't answer your question.
Where is it? Where is it?
This is now Southern Argentina.
Your desk.
Oh, in Baltimore.
Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah. This is Fuerza Aérea Argentina, Argentinian Air Force. And we're at Lago Calafate in the interior of Argentina, down opposite the Falkland Islands, opposite the town of Rio Gallegos. And this ticket on this thing, it was an hour's flight, it cost $25. It was before Argentina went bust, so maybe there's a connection. It's an F-27, and they fly hikers around, or tourists around, on extra seats in the military planes. I don't know if they still do it, but this was 1990.
Is that like on the border of Chile or something?
Yeah, it's real close to Chile. There's the Andes in the distance, and that's where we're going to go. And I'll just flip through these rather quickly. There's two things to talk about. These mountains, Cerro Torre and Cerro Fitzroy, and then the Perito Moreno Glacier, which is a wonder of the world as God made it. So, some beautiful horses. Look at the scrub country. It looks like Eastern Washington, doesn't it? And then you start to see these mountains. And here is, just so you get it all straight, that's Cerro Torre, one of the most incredible peaks in the world, and Cerro Fitzroy. And that's where we're going to. I took a bus to some place near there, and then I started walking. My goal was to walk around them. A lot of other mountains, but also glaciers coming from the Andes. And it doesn't look very steep and high to produce a glacier, but this is, I think, a 30-mile glacier coming out of the Andes and going into this lake, which is Lake Calafate.
Did you do this by yourself?
Yeah. There's never anybody around to do these things with, so. Now look at that. How do you like that in your car window? Fitzroy on the left, Torrey on the left, and Torrey means tower, so it's called Mount Tower. That's Verdet, and Fitzroy on the right. Fitzroy named for Darwin's ship, right? Wasn't his ship the Fitzroy? No, the Beagle.
Beagle.
What's the Fitzroy? Oh.
So I should be able to tell you.
You're in the southern hemisphere, you're quite far south. Everything's, you know, north is south and south is north in terms of the sun. The plants are like the same plants they find in Australia and New Zealand. I was with a couple Australians for two of the days, and they just couldn't get over how similar this was to Tasmania or New Zealand. And then you're hiking along this ridge. Just look at the near stuff where you're hiking, and then the middle stuff, it looks like Martin's Ridge sort of, and then the distance for Cerro Torre.
Are you just go across country, or are there trails there?
There was a trail here.
Yeah.
And see the trail? I should have lied and said I was going across country.
What was the temperature?
You know, nice. I don't know. 60. It was February, I think. So my idea was to leave the trail and go and touch that mountain. And so I walked across this snow field. And it cooperated because I think the only time in my life where you could actually walk up, and it was like walking to the side of the room and putting your hand on the wall. And that's where the mountain started. There were no foothills.
Interesting rock formations there.
Yeah, just look at that. And it's permanent winter on the south side of that tower. And to climb it means incredible things for the people that do it. And I met a Chilean guy who just climbed it.
What's the elevation gain from the bottom to the top of that?
I want to say 2,000 meters, so 6,000 feet. I may be wrong about that. It's not that high. This is, yeah. It's totally about 9,000 feet. I can't remember how high we were at the bottom. But it's pretty spectacular wall.
Yeah, three ledges.
So here, you just walk right up.
Tree,
and it starts at a 90 degree angle to the ground.
So is this a rock climber's paradise?
Apparently, yeah. So I got another view to look up at it from a little higher on the shoulder. And then I went back. Sorry, that's tipped. That's the snow meeting the rock. That's tipped sideways. Wow. Now Fitzroy, the other one that's a little higher actually. Same sort of approach. View back at Torrey from near Fitzroy.
Did you run into other backpackers up there? Is it pretty desolate?
Yeah, no, I probably met, I don't know, 10 people in 4 days.
From
sunset
where?
Over Torrey.
Were they all tourists or are they all?
With backpackers.
All
backpackers. Yeah. I mean, they were all tourists, they weren't locals. Nobody lives right here.
No, I know that.
Look at that moon over Torrey, sort of like a dot on the eye.
Yeah. Or a cannon shooting it out.
Yeah. So did you travel alone on part of this hike that you took? Or?
Yeah, it was all alone, except I fell in with two Australians for 2 days.
And how long were you hiking?
I think it was 6 days or four, yeah, or 4 or 6 to go around it. But here's a glacier marching into the lake. Makes you want to publish a calendar, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's just so spectacular. Those are the two Australians.
Is this National Park area?
Yeah, it is. There's Fitzroy with the kind of summit condensation you see on high mountains where the wind immediately condenses. There's some stretches where it was flat and there are beautiful lakes and wonderful forests of birch and other trees. Yeah, you just feel like, you know, somebody's built a cathedral and you're right around the block and you just keep seeing it.
What level's timberline in this area?
Oh, really low. You know, I don't know, three. Like you've been to Alaska, it gets down to 4,000 feet. Same thing, probably even less. Sorry about all the pictures, but.
I was liking that one.
They fill the picture up here. The way nothing
oh, wow.
That's dawn. That, to participate slightly in this mountain, you know, it's not the kind of thing I could ever do, but I climbed up on this ridge and camped on top of one of these pinnacles and just, you know, spent the day there. So that was this is what greeted me the next morning.
Is this a national park or just...
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's where I camped, up there on that... on the side, look near the top of that peak. There's a lake below. Lyman.
Doubtful.
A glacier below on another side. Look at the pattern of the flow. And then look off in the distance, the chain of lakes. In the very distance, Kalafate, the big lake that you're going to see with the glacier in a minute. Glacial valley. Steep hillside, little flowers. See the red flowers? This looks just like Mary Green on Bonanza. One more.
Are you on trails here, or are you just going to walk around the glacier?
I'm just walking around the glacier at this point, but there is a circuit trail around the whole both peaks okay. That is more or less well marked. You can get lost. Mm. Here we're leaving a bit behind. And suddenly it's, you know, it's getting quite fertile. Yeah. Leaving it further behind. One glacier is sort of making a run to get up, you know, and still grab you. Look at that glacier, it's like a cascade. And of course, always the flowers that grow. Then into a big forest, and I can't remember what kind of trees they were. But very, very special atmosphere.
Any wildlife around?
Yeah. Vicuñas. A kind of an ostrich. What kind of bird? I can't remember what it's called. Sort of like an ostrich?
Is that a rhea?
Ostrich? A which?
Rhea?
Yeah, rheas. Rheas.
And
guanacos, I think, which are related to alpacas.
This looks a lot like New Zealand.
Yeah.
You've seen Lord of the Rings. This is kind of a...
Right. So you had another point?
Pumas did you see, or cougars, or what did you say first?
Vicuña.
Vicuña.
What is that?
It's the smallest of the camelids. The Yama alpaca vicuña family. The one with the finest of all of their wolves. And there was a little campground at one end of the walk.
It looks hobbit-like.
Yeah. A man with a big beard feeding a calf milk.
So you're near the tip of South America?
Pretty close, not quite. There's quite a bit still to go. It's not Tierra del Fuego, it's north of that, but not so far. That's an armadillo, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And then getting out, and we hitchhiked out, or I hit, at this point was just alone, and we hitchhiked on this road, but it's kind of hitchhiking where you have to walk 10 miles between each car. and you get, you know, one last look back at where you were, and you're heading down now to Perito Moreno. And here's Perito Moreno, and I gotta explain this. This glacier is in a constant war with this lake. And the struggle between them is just one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. It's coming out of the Andes, and it hits this lake. And what's the glacier gonna do when it hits the lake?
Well, cab off.
Pardon?
Cab off.
This is too big to cab off. Oh. It marches right across the lake. About 3 miles.
And because it's not salt water, the water isn't very warm.
That probably helps. Salt water melts ice quicker than regular?
Yes.
Yeah.
That glacier's just creeping across the lake then.
It creeps across the lake, and it actually gets to the other side. So we're on the other side, and it's about 100 yards away. And it's been advancing now. I think that the cycle takes about 18 months.
To go how far? To go to the end of the lake.
Well, to get to the shore.
Oh, my.
So it gets to the shore, and the minute it does that, it becomes a dam. Uh-huh. Because the inlet is to the right here. It's a big lake, and the inlet is to the right. And so that part of the lake that's now been cut off starts to build up. Mm-hmm. And it's always melting. And I don't know, the glacier has to be on the ground because it doesn't float, right? It's too heavy to float, isn't it?
There
can be water underneath?
Yeah,
it's ice, I guess. Ice does float. It just doesn't look like it's floating. I mean, look at it, it's completely... Anyway, so the lake's working away, melting, building up sheer pressure. And the glacier's pushing against this shore. And then suddenly the glacier gets undermined enough that the lake can rush through the hole and brush away the whole snout of the glacier and destroy a quarter mile, even more I think sometimes, depending on how cataclysmic the breakthrough is. But just wipe out the snout of the glacier and drain that lake back down to the same level as the rest. And so in a matter of, I think, minutes. We didn't see that happen. You have to be there. You know, you have to call them and say, when's it going to happen? They say, February next year. You know,
did they have a videotape of that? Did you get to see it on videotape?
No, I didn't. But it's just spectacular. And that struggle between the water and the ice is just an amazing thing. And meanwhile, you have I think these were 80 meter walls. So like 250 meter to peak of ice cliff, and huge building sized pieces break off, and they create such a stir that and such a wave formation that tourists have been drowned who are down on the rocks trying to film, take a picture. A column falls, the waves come in and washes the people into the lake. So they have signs saying, don't go down there, stay up here, you know, even if it isn't quite as close as you'd like to get. And they were offering helicopter rides out amongst the seracs. But it just, you know, I think one of the most amazing, spectacular places there has to be on Earth. Perito Moreno. See the fallen ice floating in the water?
Yeah.
See the scale of the people?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
On the balcony there?
Wow.
And see where it's coming from? How flat it is?
That's very interesting when you hear that so many glaciers are receding.
Well, this was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it's doing now. It's so big, I think it'll take a long time. maybe it'll stop coming across. 12 years ago. This had just fallen, and it doesn't look like much, but this whole bright green, blue area had just gone, whoa, you know. So I quickly snapped a picture and you got a little bit of the waves. And that's downstream a little bit.
What's the temperature in the lake?
Cold.
Yeah.
Ice cold.
Ice cold. I honestly can't remember why I took this person's picture.
Queen of the Ice Falls.
Yeah.
Add a bit of color.
So you can drive to this from...
Yeah. From where?
Where?
Anywhere.
From the pole, then we can drive there?
You can. There are roads.
I take you here.
Okay, that's the end of the slide. Can somebody turn off the machine on the upper... There's that sliding button thing.
Stories.
Okay, stories. Yeah, just push all the way back. Thanks. So, somebody got a story?
Well, I want to talk about that. There's a wonderful train that goes from Lake Titicaca down to Cusco. It's one of my most favorite cities in the world. And on this train, it's people can ride in seats, they can ride on top, or they can lean out the door. It's a different price tickets.
Is this in Argentina?
What?
Is this in Argentina?
Between Bolivia and Peru.
Peru, okay.
And so you don't have any food on this plate, so you get your money out, and you're going to negotiate with these people that are at where they slow down the train. So they have these ballpoint pens, and they have the cheap ones that run out, but they write a price in their hand, and you write a price in your hand, and then you write a price in your hand, and then they write a price in the end. Then you get the chicken, or you get the vegetables, or you get whatever the food is wrapped in paper, and you bring it back into the train. Okay, then you need something to drink. You do the same thing. You write a number on your hand. You write a number on their hand. You just keep going back and forth, and they get you food, and you keep on going. Huh. I have a picture when it goes around the bend, and I lean out the window to see how many people are hanging on. I mean, it's in the view. I'm telling you, living on Lake Titicaca on an island, and wake up in the morning with this view. I mean, you just can't. It's just, the Andes are gorgeous. Yeah. Anyway, that train was a fun experience.
Yeah.
About train travel in South America, has anyone read Paul Theroux's book, The Old Patagonian Express?
I haven't, but
because it tells you, he travels through trains all the way from the northern tip of South America all the way to Patagonia. And it's just if you're interested in train travel in South America, it's fascinating because it's the most backward, primitive train system anywhere in the world. Huh. And I guess he didn't discover that until he got there. And he went on that train
You can get from A to B much easier by train than by road.
Those trains are constantly breaking down.
Well, they're at 14,000 feet at the pass.
Yeah.
You had a story about some miser hiker who you were the helicopter for? Or?
Yeah. There's one, the rescue of a mountain Scrooge. And there's another one, a coyote sniffed my toes at 17,000 feet. Should we do the mountain Scrooge?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's hear both. Talk real fast.
Well, I'll read it so I don't stray from what happened. This is the mountain Scrooge. It's in southern Switzerland. And I could see this really neat mountain that was the highest one in the area and looked very doable for a person who wants to be safe and hike another day. So I left home at 4 a.m., not a cloud in the sky. The day is going real well. The mountain was all to myself. This is in the province of Ticino, the Italian province of Switzerland in the south, when we lived in Geneva, not so far away. I thought I knew what I was in for. Towards midday, about an hour from the summit, I heard a rock fall and then distant voices from a steep and rocky face well off to my right, well off of any reasonable route. I couldn't see anybody, but I couldn't make out the nature of the calls. I could just hear that they were voices calling, and I continued to climb. got to the summit, I picnicked, I took a nap, almost went down another way, but to minimize risk, it's always good to go back the way you've gone if you haven't been there before. And so I did that. And that turned out to be an important choice because it brought me back in the area where I'd heard those voices. Crossing a glacier near where I'd heard the voices 3 hours earlier, I became aware of a small figure out on the ice. It was apparently in trouble. When the person saw me, she came running towards me, shouting as she ran. It was a young woman, and she was so distraught that she almost ran into a crevasse between the two of us. And I said, "Stop," and she stopped and went around the crevasse. And she told me her story. She and her father were out for the day, and they were lost. They were way off of their route, and he had stepped on those kind of rocks that looked like you can step on them, but when you step on them, they tip, and they fall against your ankle, or another rock comes down on top of them. I mean, it's probably one of the biggest risks around here as we hike, if you cross a boulder field and you step on the wrong rock. He had done that, and he triggered a real rock slide, which is what I'd heard. And he was hurt in both legs, and I think the smaller bone in the one leg was actually broken. I couldn't totally tell. But there was more troubling her than that. She said, "We have holiday accident insurance." We said this the other day. If you want to be rescued in the Alps, you have to buy insurance before you go, or there's no guarantee the helicopter will actually come for you. They're more laissez-faire about the responsibility you incur when you are out on your own. "We have holiday accident insurance, but my father does not want to use it to pay for the rescue helicopter because he doesn't want to lose the deductible." He wasn't right with her.
What nationality is this? Or do you
I hate to be prejudicial, but they're Dutch. That's why it's so, you know, they have to be either Scottish or Dutch. Yeah. They were Dutch. And so she said, kind of, you know, looking around, he wasn't with her. He was back at a place where he needed to get moved from. And she said, "Would I go down and call a helicopter anyway?" So this woman who loved her dad dearly, she was 20, was feeling like she had to just cross him and get help. We went across the glacier to her father. He was bleeding from both of his legs. And immediately I came, he forced himself to stand up. And you could just see that was really not a good thing to do. Great pain on his face. And to me, he didn't mention insurance, he didn't mention helicopter, he only said he would be able to make it down, and refused even any kind of first aid that I tried to. So male hormones, pride, human pride, you name it, we're starting to operate in this situation. To prove the point, he turned and set off across the glacier, powered by his will rather than his legs, because his legs weren't cooperating very well with him. His daughter was just distraught, and right there she was sort of faced with her allegiance to him and worry for him, and she gave me a kind of a helpless look and took off after him. So what was I going to do? By myself, I'm not sure what I could do, but by themselves they were certainly in no condition to either stay put or to go down. No telling what would happen to them or to the weather. Well, I went for help if I did what she had asked me. And no guarantee that I could get to a helicopter and get it called into a helicopter before nightfall. Because it was at this time, I think, about 3 p.m. We could stay where we were, but he wasn't going to stay put, it was pretty clear. He was determined to save himself and to get down from that mountain. There was still quite a bit of daylight. It gets dark there at 9:30 or so at night at that point, so I had about 6 hours to work with. And I was there, I was free to help. I have to put in another plug for Marion. She would just have to live with the fact that I wasn't coming home when I said I was. But, you know, we have a margin to work with, and I thought I could work with that margin. I caught up to the hobbling man and his still sobbing daughter. I took their backpacks, and his was really heavy for a day trip. Really heavy, but I just took it, I didn't say anything. And for the next 7 hours, we worked our way down over snow and then rock. Despite his strong will, the man collapsed in pain before we even got off the glacier. And it was clear that he did need a helicopter, and that the helicopter would be free, and that the helicopter would be me. I carried him piggyback for a time, but that got too much. And so I half carried him, sort of like the wounded soldier, you know, arm over my shoulder and that kind of walking. So he had to use his legs somewhat. And finally it got so steep I couldn't do that. So I put him on a rope and I would lower him. I'd stop and lower him down a pitch and then come down myself and do it again. And so the progress was really slow. His daughter, whose name was Madeline, stayed upset all day, which made her a separate liability. She had to be watched at every turn. I honestly thought, she's going to fall off the edge because she's not thinking. You know how your emotions are critical to your safety. Because she seemed to have lost all sense of direction and safety. When we stopped for a rest, he allowed me to look at the ankle, but we couldn't get the boot off because of the pain. And he introduced himself at one of these rests, and he said his name is Hubert Bartmans, and he was from Holland. By this time, he had begun to feel like he owed me something, and so he began rummaging around in his backpack. It turned out he was a walking grocery store. I still had a food of my own, and I declined his food. I was carrying his pack anyway, so eating his food wasn't going to lighten my load any. And I just thought I'd eat what I had. But he insisted, and to prove his point, he began pulling various items out of the bag. French delicacies, all kinds of interesting things in tins. And then finally, when I still refused, he said, go ahead, take it. I own a wholesale warehouse. It didn't cost me anything. So we continued, and it seemed that I had to take more and more of his weight. The day faded, I began to get tired. Hubert still protested from time to time about all the mountains he had climbed, and that nothing like this had ever happened to him before. The mountain hut that was our goal came into view. We shouted for help, but no one could hear us. You can see things long before you can get to them. And we thought, hey, they'll come and get us, but they didn't. Nobody came out. We finally reached it just as night got completely dark. And it was lucky for him, because with no daylight, a helicopter wouldn't come that day. Too late for a helicopter that day, so lucky for his pocketbook. The ranger at the hut took father and daughter under his wing and dressed their wounds, and he said he would make sure to get them out in the morning. After a rest, I decided to continue on back to our campsite, still 4 or 5 hours below. The daughter, Madeline, thanked me for saving her father's life, and I think he mumbled something too. I got back to my somewhat worried wife and family near midnight. The story basically ends there, except his conscience must have overcome his miserliness at least 3 times, because he called me long distance from the Netherlands, and with the same pushiness that he wanted me to eat his caviar on the side of the mountain, insisted that I come to the Netherlands and visit him. Because I said I travel and I sometimes stop in Amsterdam as a connecting place. He said, you've got to come visit me. And you know, you kind of ask yourself, in your own mind when you're listening, you know, why would I want to do that? And then he sent me, and this is the pièce de la résistance for the story, he sent me a beautiful coffee table book called Mountains. And on the cover is one of those photographs you can take with a long lens that stack 5 different colors of blue ridges together and all that stuff. Okay. And I'm flipping through it and it's really nice. And then I start noticing something, and you know, I flick the paper, and with a little mark there, doesn't go away. I thought it was just a piece of dust or something. And I do another look and hold it up to the light, and the book is a second. So it's like nothing this guy could do was untainted or untouched by his sense of, you know, value for money. And you know, I can relate. I really believe in value for money too. So that was the Mount Scrooge.
Why didn't you jettison his pack, or you know, you're carrying such a helping him? And
yeah.
Him.
Did you? Well, I guess I was scared. What he'd do if I dropped his pack? I wanted those tins. No. It wasn't that heavy, but it was. It's probably 30 pounds or 25 pounds for a day pack. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, how many people here carry tins? Tinned food.
Did you ever visit him in the Netherlands?
Well, I think I would if I was really there, but you know, he has to compete with work and family. And he already competed pretty successfully that day. So anyway, that's Hubert Parkman. Nice guy, really. Daughter Madeline. But amazing how he lived out the stereotype of the frugal Dutchman. Why don't we stop there? I just wanted to mention that there's a few copies of this left, and there are really neat things at the front of each chapter, as well as the fantastic story he tells about a commercial expedition on Everest. And he's gone through, Krakauer has, and picked up statements from different mountain writings that I think when you add them all together do the best job I've seen of leaving open the question of why people climb mountains or why they go on adventures that have a little bit of danger involved. So I recommend it with that in mind. And thank you for your...
It's a good story, too.
Fantastic story.
How did you get into it?
Read the book and you'll see all of my reasons sprinkled around here and there. It's just...
Where did you grow up?
In Papua New Guinea.
Oh.
Which is all mountains, so that might have something to do with it.
Because, you know, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, didn't have any mountains. One of the men I went to high school with became a famous mountaineer. I always wondered, how did he get that interest?
You should get his other book.
I'll try.
It's a skinny book.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you.
Increasingly poorly done on the trekking business. I mean,
really? You think so?
Yeah. It's corrupting the villages, dirtying the place. You know, it's not the worst, but all the reports I have are that you could really do it with a lot less impact on the people and on the landscape.
Interesting. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be a poor country. You're going for the broke on what it can sell.
They don't take care of waste.
Me too.
They don't take care of waste and so forth.
I know. They try, but there's a lot.
No, that's very, very poor. Yeah. The sanitation, he said, was just awful.
Yeah.
It was.
He said it was very, 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 very poor.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's something, like Hillary has done it with his foundation work. He supports schools and orphanages and things.
Edmund
Hillary, yeah. Okay. He's devoted a huge chunk of his life to that. It's like paying back the debt he owes that piece of land and those people.
That's interesting.
And I think you could do something similar here. As long as you keep out the foreign, the non-local interests.
Yeah.
Like Cusco. You know, which everybody goes to. Apparently, what I heard was that virtually every business there is owned by people from Lima.
Yeah.
And or people from Cusco who are, you know, the elite.
I was thinking, my husband's an Arctic oceanographer, and he's doing a series of experiments on the North Pole.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh my God, the Russians and the French are there.
Yeah.
Oh, he was so appalled. Mm-hmm. And they set up this camp for 10
near the North Pole?
40 miles from the North Pole. Mm,
on the ice then.
Wow. On the ice. They're out there and you pay hundreds of thousands of dollars, people are paying.
To go to the North Pole.
And they go in and you can ski to the North Pole from the camp, or you can take a flight something or other, or you can take
a helicopter.
And he said, it is the most corrupt, horrible thing he's ever seen. And the French and the Russians are the ones that have sent this up.
You mean corrupt in terms of pollution and corrupt?
Pollution, fighting each other, one guy threatening to pull out and leave them stranded and forcing them to pay him a bunch of money in order not to do it. And it is bad news. So I was thinking about that when you were talking about
it.
And people are paying the money to do it.
Well, look at that guy who went into space for $20 million.
That's right.
Yeah.
The same idea.
Yeah.
Well, thanks much.
Thank you very
much. You're welcome.